listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan or on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, November 8th, 2023. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunav Cheej, Hawa, Salamat for joining the conversation. On today's show, Juno Community Bands previews their upcoming performance of Handel's Messiah. We'll chat with Juno Audubon Society about this Thursday's talk on bats in winter. UAS Evening at Egan's talk this week is about cruise industry impacts, along with the screening of the film Cruise Boom. And we'll have a quick preview on this weekend's Jump Film Festival. Those conversations, music, and more coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Listening to perhaps one of the most recognized pieces of music ever. And you're listening to that on Juno Afternoon, community supported on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Just a programming note before we get started today, Juno Afternoon will be off this Friday in observance of the Veterans Day holiday. Also, both Juno Afternoon and Culture Rich Conversations are available now as podcasts, so you can listen on demand whenever you like. Just search for them in your podcast catcher of choice or visit ktoo.org/podcasts. Okay, So, Juno Community Bands provides the opportunity for Juno's adult wind and percussion players to make music together with a variety of concerts throughout the year. And coming up next is part one and what you just heard, the Hallelujah Chorus, of Handel's Messiah. It's happening Thanksgiving weekend on Saturday night, November 25th, and Sunday afternoon, November 26th. And you can find out more at junocommunityband.org. Here to share today about this awesome concert is Sarah McNair Grove, president, and Rich Moore, who is conducting this upcoming concert. Gunath Chish Hadye Adi to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Of course. Good afternoon. Yeah, good afternoon. Good Juno afternoon. So as we were joking before the show, when you start to hear that piece of music, because you may not even know who it was written by, but you've heard that piece of music before in your life somewhere. And when you hear it, you know two things. One, that you know that song and you're going to sing along to it. And two, that the holidays are coming.
That's exactly right.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, Sarah, is this something that you all do on the regular, this particular concert, or is this something new?
This is something new and something that we're really excited about. Oh, as you mentioned, everybody knows the Hallelujah Chorus, and all the rest of the music that goes with oratorio is equally gorgeous. And it's been something that I've had in my heart that I've just wanted to do for many, many years. And I finally found an arrangement for wind instruments that we as the Juno Community Band players could participate in. But, of course, we needed a chorus, and that's where Rich came in. Mm-hmm. So he's been putting together the chorus, and this is our first time including vocals with our instrumental music, and we're just really excited to branch out and do something different.
I love that. I love that you're sort of, you know, pushing the envelope a little bit and getting outside of your what you usually would do.
Yes.
And it seems like a perfect piece of music to do that with.
It really is. I mean, when you look around, there's so many arrangements of Messiah. There's all different kinds of things. It seems to be a piece of music a lot of people do a lot of things with. And I think this one is just going to be gorgeous.
Yeah. So, Rich, how's it going to work with, because as Sarah was saying, Juno Community Bands is predominantly wind instruments plus some percussion. Mm-hmm. So does that change the orchestration of how you're doing the concert?
It does. It does. Normally it is a piece of music full of strings and a few winds. And the percussion, of course, but now it is all winds. We do have a couple of strings down in the lower end, the bass and the cello form a continuo part down at the bottom just to kind of solidify the whole thing. But the flutes and the oboes and the clarinets take the place of those strings that you would normally hear in Handel's original arrangement. It's a little bit bracing at first when you hear that because we are all used to that beautiful lush string sound, and not to say that winds can't be lush, but it's a little bit different at first, but I think everybody's going to melt in really easily and quickly because it's a beautiful sound.
Well, it'll be unique, right?
It will.
Because
it may
not be an arrangement that you've heard before.
That's right. That's right.
And then, how are you doing the chorus?
Well, as far as
in terms of the number of people.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. We put out a call a few months ago and have just recruited from a community of singers that we have known in the past that have performed in various groups around and out to just the community at large and have gotten a great response from both. We have about 35 to 40, depending on the evening rehearsal of mixtures of ages from in the 70s, folks are still singing in their 70s all the way down into the early 20s. So we've got a great assortment of age and experience levels, and it's going to be great. Yeah, it's something.
That's going to be cool.
It is. It is an awesome sight to look out and see the community coming together again.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, and that's part of what your mission is, Sarah, is, as Juno Community Bands, is to bring people together who are, in the true sense of the word, amateur, right? Which is for the love of, you know, it's like you do it because you want to do it and you're getting together with the other people who are really loving it and putting on these concerts.
Yeah, you're right. That's one of the things that we sort of really want to push, is that we have a lot of talent in this town and we want to find a way to showcase it and let everybody come and enjoy the the talents that their neighbors have. It's a wonderful thing. And Rich and I were just talking while we were waiting. There's a real excitement in the air among the singers and the instrumentalists about this coming concert. It's just kind of sparkles when you get in the rehearsals.
That's going to be so fun. So I have a couple questions about the selection. So I know that, like, let's talk about Handel's Messiah for a couple minutes in terms of the construction of it, right? So you're doing part one of the three parts. So tell us a little bit about the different parts and why we chose to do part one.
Okay. So the three parts are basically outlining a biblical viewpoint of the Messiah. And the first part that we are doing outlines kind of the prophetic point of view of a lot of Old Testament scriptures predicting and prophesying the arrival of Messiah. And so that fits very well into the Christmas season as we prepare for that arrival as well. And then, of course, we had to do the Hallelujah Chorus, which is in actually the third part, I believe, either the late second or the third part, because you just can't do Messiah and not do Hallelujah Chorus.
Yeah. Well, I think because the second part deals with sort of the doesn't it deal with the second part deals with the resurrection?
That's the third part.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's
okay.
The third part. The second part is actually a beautifully sad but wonderful part of that. Most of the music coming out of the second part is about the death of.
Oh, right. Uh-huh. Okay. Right. Right.
And from the Christian point of view, it's not a sad thing. I mean, from the idea that the death had to take place in order to have the resurrection. Right.
Right.
So,
right.
So, from that point of view, it all fits together beautifully. The prophecy regarding Christ, his sacrifice, and then part three, the resurrection, as you said.
I see. Okay.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
So is it because we have but why only doing part one? Is it because that's long enough? Like, is it really long? Is it really long?
No, not particularly. Well, the whole oratorio is a couple hours if you do all of it together.
Yeah.
I think this was a bit of a test balloon because we're just kind of getting on our feet again after COVID on a performance footing. And so we wanted to see, as Sarah mentioned a while ago, this was kind of a new thing for the band to do. And so we weren't quite sure how it was going to be received either. So because we were not sure, you know, that we could man a whole production, the whole 2.5 hours of it, and just finding performing forces, because it's a big work if you try to do it all together. So this was a good usable chunk of that. So
And part one is an hour. So, I mean, it's not a small hunk of music. There's a lot of music there.
Yeah, right.
A lot of music to figure out.
But it's easily digestible. If folks have never been to Messiah, it could be a little bit of an overwhelming thing. But we're doing that first part, and it's upbeat. It's up-tempo. It's a lot of great music that I think people might have heard somewhere in the background and be very easy to relate to.
Now, I had to figure out what an oratorio was. Can you explain that? So we know what the difference between that is and sort of an opera and all the, you know, the different terms.
Certainly. An opera has scenery, it has set, it has lighting, it's got the whole thing. It is a production from top to bottom. An oratorio is just an unstaged version of that. There are no sets, there's no scenery, there's no costumes. It is just the narrative, basically, and there's hardly ever any interaction between the characters. It's just this person sings here, then the choir will sing, another person will sing there. And so it does tell the, you know, a story, a narrative, but never interacting like you would have characters in an opera.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So more like a concert style.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And Sarah, tell us a little bit about who's going to be involved in this.
As we've mentioned, we have the Wind Orchestra, which are members of Taku Winds, our wind ensemble, and we have the community chorus, but we haven't yet talked about our four soloists. There are four soloists here. Our soprano soloist is Sarah Radke Brown. Alto soloist is Christina Pollock. Tenor is Jacob Miller, and bass is David Miller. So we're just delighted to have these four great soloists.
That is really great.
It's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, that's so awesome. And tell us again where it's happening, when it's happening, how do we get involved, how do we get more information or get tickets?
Okay. It is the weekend after Thanksgiving, so you can have a great Thanksgiving dinner, do a little bit of public market if you like that, and then come and relax Saturday evening at 7 o'clock or Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and it is at Northern Light Church. And it will be just be donations at the door. We want the public to come.
That is so kind of you to do, because it doesn't take no effort to put this thing on, right? I mean, and it's really a group
We've
coming together.
We've been working
together.
For 2 months at least.
Whoa.
On just rehearsals and, of course, all the preparation ahead of that.
What makes it nice is when it's a donation, it can actually be more than the ticket price if you have the means, right?
Yes. Absolutely. We don't want people to stay away, but yes, we would like people to support us.
Yeah, absolutely. You want people to come in and do that. And Rich, how has it been to sort of work with the group? Like, has there been, you know, what has been like a wonderful, bright moment over the last couple months?
Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier, just seeing the diversity in age, people who have sung Messiah. A chorus member has just joined recently, and she came in and said, I sang this 20 years ago. And when I heard you guys were doing it, I had to come sing again. And that's been one of the greatest things, is seeing the community get behind that and not just supported by coming in. We would love for everyone to come out, but to actually actively participate in that. So seeing the community get excited again about public performing, and seeing all these disparate parts, the planning stage, the rehearsal stage, and then obviously the performance, seeing all these things come together. We haven't had that much in Juneau in the past 2 or 3 years, so it's great to see
alive
again.
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
So everyone should get out on Thanksgiving weekend. Like you said, it's a perfect match for public market, do a little shopping, and then go listen to this awesome music.
That's it. Yeah, it starts the Christmas season.
Yeah, well, Gwyneth Cheech, for coming in and telling us all about it. You can find out more at Juneau Community Band with no S, .org. And Rich and Sarah, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us about this.
Thank you for having us.
It's going to be so good. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Glen A.D. have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot, once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. Listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This weekend, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, a free film festival featuring locally made short films will be taking place at the Gold Town Nick on Shattuck Way, downtown Juneau. It's the Juneau Underground Motion Picture Society Film Festival 2023, aka the Jump Film Festival. Here to get us primed is, of course, Pat Race. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Boston.
It's so good to see you.
Good to see you, too. It's good to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Wanted to get you on for just a couple minutes and talk about this awesome festival that's coming up. So who is and what is the Jump Film Festival?
We're a nonprofit, and our mission is to support and promote local filmmakers. And so we provide screening opportunities, and we do as a short film festival where we accept submissions that are 10 minutes or less and by local filmmakers or films that have a connection to Juno.
Right. Yeah. So you wanted them to have some kind of either, what is that? Is that a loose connection?
Yeah, it's pretty loose. So if it's, so if someone lived here, we've had people that have sent stuff in that was like film they recorded and they moved away and then they made a film and then sent it back. Or we've had people that visited and made a film here that aren't from here, but submitted a thing. And so yeah, is if the piece of work has a connection to Juno, then we're into sharing it.
That's awesome. And of course, the wonderful collaboration that Goldtown opens up their doors and is like,
yeah,
it's free. Everybody just come and have a good time and celebrate filmmaking from people here in Alaska.
Yeah. And we do accept donations, but I usually encourage people to make those after they've seen the films.
Judge by the content.
Yeah. There's some great films this time around. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing what people are capable of here in our little small town.
It's a wonderful look at just being creative. I mean, you can make a phone you can make a film on your phone now,
yeah,
right? Like
yeah,
you can, you have access to the material. So to be able to do something, and it's not too long, less than 10 minutes is fine. And some of them I've seen before are really short.
Yeah.
There is always a great variety of topics and subjects and humor and serious, and it can be really sort of run the gamut.
Yeah. And I think the shortest one's 45 seconds. We've got comedy, we've got deeply serious, we've got music videos and documentary, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, that's going to be awesome. Yeah. And tell us a little bit about some of the lineup or what else is going on with that.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got some of the films. We've got a animated film by a little kid who's like 13 who made a stop motion animation film. We've got music videos featuring George Kuhar, Annie Bartholomew, Muskake Collective. All kinds of local artists are showing off their work. We've got cultural films from Clinkin Haida. We've got comedy, sketch comedy, you know, all kinds of different variety. And so I think there's like a little something for everyone in there. And there's a lot of familiar faces. So you'll probably go and learn something about someone in your community, whether that's their sense of humor or their or their occupation.
How long has the Jump Film Festival been going?
Since 2002. So this is our 21st year.
Wow. I know there was probably a couple misses in that time we don't speak of anymore, but like when we lost time.
Yeah, we were actually pretty active. We didn't show a lot of locally made films during that time because it was hard to make them, but but we did do some drive-in movies at the Glacier for Science on Screen. We coordinated with Colette Costa at Goldtown on that.
Yeah, okay, nice.
Yeah.
So 21 years.
Yeah.
That's a lot of films.
Yeah, it is. I figure we have probably screened more than 700 locally made short films.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Is there going to be like an archive or some kind of retrospective version of the festival at some point?
I don't know. I think we did one at year 15 and we might do another one when we hit 25. Yeah, yeah, probably. And I've got, you know, some of it's probably lost, but I think I have most of all of the festivals in one form or another. I just found a VHS tape of the 2002 festival.
What, of the very first festival? Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah, that must be amazing to look at.
Well, yeah, once I find a VCR, right?
We might have one here at KTOO. Yeah. I don't know. That would be really fun to see what that looked like from 20 years ago. Yeah. And also just because I know that the films sometimes take on what's going on in the zeitgeist at the moment and the humor of that year, mm-hmm, or what's going on. So to look back at stuff that was going on that maybe we forgot about or that we, you know, can even laugh more at now, yeah, is kind of fun as well.
There's been a lot of social evolution and community growth in the last 21 years. And there's also just been a lot of change. It's really fun to see these older films that feature parts of Juno that no longer exist. Last year, we had a film that was filmed in the 60s and included the former KTOO studios, television studios, where the Spam Can building is located.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was a lot of fun.
Some history.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So tell us again, when, where, how do we get involved? Do we need to, you know, where can we find out more?
You can find out more at jumpsociety.org. You can also submit films there. We just kind of have a rolling film submissions. And then the screenings this weekend are Thursday night at 7 and Friday night at 7 and 9. And then we're going to do a matinee Sunday at 4:30. And that's all at the Gold Town Theater. And they have a website as well.
Oh, I think I accidentally in the intro mentioned Saturday. So nothing on Saturday.
Nothing on Saturday. But I think there is a film from a visiting artist on Saturday that they're hosting that should be really good about cruise ships. And
we're talking about that today. Cruise Boom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
They're going to be on the show.
I'm very excited about that. Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. So Thursday at 7, Friday has two shows, 7 and 9, and Sunday a matinee at 4:30 p.m. It's the Jump Film Festival, the 21st edition.
Well, we actually used to do two a year, so this is probably like our, 40-some-odd festival.
Oh, but, yeah. Man, that's awesome. Yeah. That's so awesome. And, of course, you can find out more at jumpsociety.org. Pat, thanks for coming in and giving us a little taste, a little preview of what's to come. But really, get out and see these films this weekend for sure.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Up next, Juno Audubon Society and their upcoming talk on bats in winter. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
This is Bird Note. Wren or robin, finch or chickadee, most birds love a good bath. Bigger birds, too. A Cooper's hawk may stand and splash in a birdbath for half an hour. Bathing helps keep feathers in prime condition. Some birds get the fluids they need from their food, but many birds need a drink at least twice a day. In natural settings, birds may drink or bathe at the shallow rim of a pond or stream, or in puddles. We can recreate this in our built environment by placing bird baths at different heights, including right on the ground. Small birds may visit only shallow bird baths, an inch or two deep. Putting rocks in the bird bath gives birds a place to rest and preen, and keeps insects from drowning. Water is important not only during hot or dry seasons when it's in short supply, but also during the cold season, when natural sources may freeze. Water is essential for birds, and supplying clean water for them to drink and bathe in is a great way to help maintain native bird life. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know you can listen to Bird Note in your podcast app? Subscribe to Bird Note Daily and never miss an episode.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Juno Audubon Society helps to conserve the natural ecosystems of Southeast Alaska, focusing on birds, other wildlife, and their habitats, offering a variety of bird walks and other programs throughout the year. And this Thursday, November 9th at 6:30 p.m., out at UAS, they have a talk, Bats in Winter. Let's find out what this is all about. I'm joined by Brenda Wright and Karen Blavis. Gunath Chishat Yadi for you both being here today. It's really nice to see you.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Brenda, is this sort of the start, or are we in the beginnings of the winter Juno Audubon talk on Thursday season?
Yes, we started in October and we go through April.
Nice.
So we have a few more coming up.
All right, great. And we can find out more always at junoaudubon.org, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Karen, bats in winter. This is an interesting topic because is it sort of like they signal something about winter happening, or what is the idea behind this talk on Thursday?
Well, most of our research, I'm a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and I'm with the Threatened, Endangered, and Diversity Program. And here in Southeast, we've been focused primarily on bats for the last quite a few years now. And the main reason I started studying bats was because of a disease called white-nose syndrome, which affects bats while they're hibernating, which is why we've focused, you know, most of our research on what bats are doing in the winter here.
Oh, I see. Okay. And what does that syndrome do to them?
So it's a fungus that grows on bats while they hibernate because, you know, while bats are hibernating, basically all their systems slow way down. Mm. And so that includes their immune system is therefore suppressed. And so that puts them in a really poor position to fight off something like a fungus. And it basically invades the tissues. It irritates the bats. It changes their metabolism. It makes them arouse more frequently. And arousals are very energetically expensive. So they end up burning up all their fat reserves before spring comes. And so they end up starving to death.
Oh, my gosh. So the research is to try to figure out how to help that process not happen. Is that sort of what you're working on or why it happens to maybe figure out what to do about it?
Well, you know, we were concerned about our bats. And the other reason I wanted to study bats is we knew so little about them. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't know what they were doing in the winter. We didn't know if they were we didn't know where they were hibernating. And, you know, we assumed they were hibernating in caves like they did back east. But, you know, me and biologists throughout the West kept looking for bats in caves and not finding them. And so we realized, okay, well, they're not hibernating in caves, so where are they? Mm. And so we started a radio telemetry study to figure that out.
Oh, wow. And what did you discover?
So it's pretty interesting. They are basically on these steep hillsides, crawling into spaces between the rocks. And so these are basically talus slopes that are covered with a soil layer. And so if you find a hole in the ground and look inside on one of these slopes, it's going to be all rock under there. And so these jumbles of rocks, you know, there's all these interstitial spaces between them and the bats just crawl into those.
What?
It's crazy.
And that's happening in Southeast Alaska.
Yeah. So there's a couple ridges here. There's one right above up at Fish Creek on North Douglas. And that was one of our main study areas.
Oh, my. Wow. That's fascinating, Brenda. Okay. Are they individually hibernating in between or can they fit like a, because I know that sometimes they group up, right, when they hibernate. The only time I've seen it is I think it was down in Carlsbad Caverns where mm-hmm. they do the thing and they all fly out at 6 o'clock or whatever mm-hmm. when you see them. But they stick together. But in this situation, is it smaller groups that are sort of hibernating together?
It's definitely smaller groups that can fit in a cave or mine because these are small spaces. And we don't know. We can't see into them. So we can't see the bats from the surface because, you know, it's really hard to get in there. These spaces are small and, you know, the rocks, you know, you got to kind of weave your way in and around. And it's just really hard to do.
You need one of those special cameras like they have at the hospital.
We've tried one, but it's actually hard to get it. Because the rocks will take a turn and you know, so it's got to be stiff enough that you can keep moving it forward, but not so stiff it can't make the turns. And so we've gotten about a meter deep, and that's about as far as we can go, given the technology we've. So, yeah, it's been challenging to study them. But what we have been able to do is put trail cameras outside the entrances. Mm. And so they don't always trigger, but it gives us some sense of, you know, so what happens is a lot of times the bats will come to the roost, they'll maybe do a circle or two before they land and crawl into that hole.
Yeah.
And so if they do that circle, they'll trigger the camera. And then when they land and crawl in, we can see that. We get a video of it. And so we can count the number of videos. So we've gotten, I think, up to 12 bats crawling into the same space.
Okay.
So it's possible they are clustered in the same area in there.
Yeah. Because I when you were first describing it, it felt like it was like an isolated bat would go into, you know, a space between the rocks because that's the only place they could find. And I'm sure there may be something like that, like where there's only one or two, but it seems like 12 seems a good number, right? In terms, because they would also, wouldn't they get warmth from each other to sort of be inside that space a little bit?
Yeah, it certainly would provide some warmth and some additional protection against dehydration. Although the idea of, you know, while they're hibernating is actually to stay cold.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
I see. Okay.
But clustering also does provide some protection from dehydration, although these spaces are really wet. here. It's like 100% relative humidity. And
now this, did you say it was called white nose disease or white nose something?
What was it? So when they first found it, it was the fungus is visible as kind of a white fuzz on the nose of the bats. And so that's how it got its name. But it grows not just on the muzzle, but on the wings and forearms of the bat. And it'll basically chew away, eat away the wings.
Wow.
You know, of the bat. So if a bat can survive the winter, it can usually heal the damage. But the trick is surviving the winter with that kind of tissue loss.
And is this particular problem only happening in colder climates like this? Like, is it only happening in certain areas, or does the white nose thing happen everywhere?
So it's really interesting because the fungus is actually found not just in North America, but Europe and Asia as well.
Mm.
And bats in both both Europe and Asia will also develop white nose syndrome. However, they don't die from it.
Mm.
And recent studies have found it seems to be that in those places, for whatever reason, the levels of fungus. So, you know, once a bat is infected and goes into a hibernaculum, a cave or a mine, like the fungus spreads really easily because bats will move around, you know, inside there and contact the walls. And, you know, once it's infected, it's never going to be not infected. So the fungus will be there, the spores will be there. And so, but there's something that happens in North America. What tends to happen is, you know, after the first year or two, there's just a high level of fungus present year round in those areas. So the bats come in, you know, in the fall completely, they may be completely healthy, but they quickly acquire the fungus. The fungus has all winter to grow, and that's why they die. In Europe, there's something, whether it's a competition or predation thing, but something is reducing those levels of those fungus over the summer. So the fungus is still present in the caves and mines, but in very low levels. And so it takes a long time for the bats to come into contact with the spores. And so the fungus doesn't have nearly as long to grow. And so it doesn't have long enough to grow to actually kill the bats.
Wow. This is fascinating, and you are going to learn so much about this on Thursday night at UAS at the Egan Lecture Hall. And it sounds amazing. It's at 6:30 p.m. at UAS. I wanted to play just a little bit of sound of a bat, and then I have one question for you, Brenda.
Okay.
But let's hear just this so we can get a little sense. This is a little brown bat, and it just gives you a sense of their sound and their sonar, I guess. Yeah, that's amazing. I love that. I mean, that's just what are we hearing there, Karen?
It's probably been frequency divided, or they have different methods of because, you know, bats produce ultrasound, which we can't hear with our human ears. So they've got to lower the frequency so that we can actually hear it.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be an amazing talk on Thursday. That's all I can say. And Brenda, I also just wanted to mention that I know the bird count is coming up in December, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. We'll have more news for everybody about that shortly, but not this time. But
yeah, and I know we'll probably have you back for that. And then I also am noticing, looking ahead for this show today, that the website seems to have been upgraded.
Yes, we have a brand new website.
Giant upgrade.
A very large one. We had an amazing person do this for volunteer work forever, and we decided as a group that it was time to actually maybe get a little more modern than 23 years ago. But we certainly thank our former webmaster very, very much. George Udermull is a hero.
Yeah, and you can check it out at JunoAudubon.org. Again, it's Bats in Winter. Wats in Binter, I was going to say. Bats in Winter. It's November 9th, this Thursday, 6:30 p.m., the UAS Egan Lecture Hall, room 112. Karen Blavis will be giving the talk. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Boston.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks very much.
Up next, Cruise Boom and Impacts. It's the subject of both the Evening at Egan Lecture and a new documentary film. We'll discuss both here next on Juno Afternoon from KTOO.
Around 480,000 cruise passengers are expected to travel to Sitka this summer, more than double Sitka's typical cruise year. Globally, the cruise industry is booming. And with that staggering increase come a lot of questions.
Are we going to be ready? Are we going to be prepared?
Yeah, I feel like I'm witnessing my community change right in front of me.
I want my friends and I want my neighbors to do well. The pie is big enough that everybody can have a slice of it.
They want to come here.
But they want to come to Sitka. They don't want to come to Disneyland.
Are they a good partner for us as a community? What happens to communities that try to control the amount of cruise ship traffic, tourists that they have?
Tourism doesn't just have to happen to you. You can help shape it.
You're listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno
Ok
Bay.
Nope.
And online at kto.org, the video went into the trailer went into the next one. We were listening to the trailer for Cruise Boom there. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This Friday, the Evening at Egan lecture series continues with Impacts and Responses, Cruise Ships and Northern Communities. It will be followed by a new documentary from Ellen Frankenstein called Cruise Boom, which will also play on Saturday night at the Gold Town. It's a pleasure to welcome to the studio 2K, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson, Karen Silkitis, Dean of the UAS Arts and Sciences, Dr. Jim Powell, UAS Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center Research Professor. That is quite a title. And also via Zoom, we have filmmaker Ellen Frankenstein. Can you hear me okay, Ellen?
I can, and my titles seem so short compared to my
other guests. Just call me Jim.
After all that, it's just Jim. Jim, Ellen, and Karen, welcome to you both.
Thanks so much,
all.
Thanks. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into it. Let's start with this Evening at Egan lecture, Jim, like Impacts and Responses, Cruise Ships and Northern Communities. What can we expect on Friday in terms of this talk?
Hopefully it's a conversation with the community about cruise ship impacts. And I'm not just talking about negative impacts. I'm talking about positive impacts. But that evening, we're going to do two things, as you mentioned. One, there's going to be a fairly short presentation by myself, about 15, 20 minutes on impacts. And then we'll go to the film, Ellen's film. So we'll talk about those impacts. Mainly the environmental impacts, because that doesn't get as much airtime. We get a lot on, you know, the benefits. There's a lot of economic information and it's out there. It's transparent. It should be anyway. But putting together all the environmental impacts is hard to do because it's been siloed. Air, water, noise, wildlife. And that's what we're going to do. We're also going to look at, it's a National Science Foundation grant that funded the study. And it's in five different places in the north: here, Nome, Akureyri, Iceland, Bergen, Norway, and Visby, Sweden. So I'm going to talk about four of those because we haven't got the last one done yet. Some preliminary findings. What did we find when we look at these communities and how they're managing cruise ships? How did they do that? And because we're one of the world leaders, we had the first plug-in cruise ship. We had one of the first wastewater treatment laws in the world. So we're very innovative here in Juneau, and we've had to be because we have lots of cruise ship passengers.
Yeah, I know. And you were talking about the things we normally hear about, right, which is sort of the amount of visitors that we get and the financial impact that those visitors have on the community. And we broke records this year and all that stuff after, you know, being sort of, you know, lessened by the time we don't speak of from the last few years. And so to see that, that's what we hear about mostly. But this sort of the actual environmental impacts of what's going on all of the different areas is really fascinating. And how did the other locations, how did it all come together in terms of choosing those locations? Was it similar size communities or similar size amount of ships coming through those environments?
We were being opportunistic. We have knowledge because I live here in Juneau and I was on the assembly for 9 years and I've been dealing with this for a long time and now I'm a researcher. So is Juneau. Nome, because it's north and it's very strategic for the future. They're building a whole new port, and part of that reason for having a port is cruise ships, not just military and mining and other things. And then the other locations, because we wanted Arctic. It had to be Arctic because under the grant, the National Science Foundation grant, we had to stay in the Arctic. But it was nice because they're just getting cruise ships, or they've had them for a while. And so we linked up with four different universities involved. There's about 11 researchers. We have economists, two people from George Washington University there's a director of the Tourism International Studies Program that's on the team. So we have some really good people. We have people in each of those locations that have local knowledge, and that's really important because we're talking about community impacts.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Absolutely.
And this is a little different this evening. The format's a little different, and I think that maybe the dean would like to talk about that.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Thanks, Jim. So especially because we're showing a film, we're not live streaming in the same way that our evening at Egan lectures are usually live streamed. But we also wanted to change venue a little bit. I think this venue is great for viewing a film. So instead of just being downstairs in the kind of open library with the windows, we wanted to be in a venue that would show a film better. So we're in that Egan Lecture Hall.
Oh, absolutely.
So same building,
yeah,
but just inside the lecture hall itself.
I see. Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. And you know, it's funny when you said, Jim, when you said Nome, that's not the place I first think of when I think about going on a cruise, but they actually are looking forward to having some industry there, huh?
Absolutely. People that cruise are looking for something a little different. And Nome is a little different and very different from Juneau.
Yeah.
I used to work out of Nome for 5 years or so. So it was the first time I went there this summer. I was doing research there on this project. And yeah, it's going to be interesting. There, I don't want to give you any of the research so far, but they're just starting to get cruise ships.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
they're
yeah.
really – the infrastructure, everything else, you know, we're built out. We've been doing this for – decades.
Yeah.
Them, not so much.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So they're just getting started, which is interesting.
Just getting
because
started.
They could probably use the information on these environmental impacts because they obviously the community and the government and whoever is like, oh, yeah, this financial impact is going to be great. But what is it going to do to a community?
The other thing that's interesting about Nome is you have a very strong and large indigenous population.
Mm-hmm.
And there's subsistence practices right down on the shore.
Oh, wow.
So there's things to consider. You've got musk oxes wandering around town.
Oh, man.
You actually do have that.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with being a Nome resident and then having people come into your community and, you know, just everything that's involved?
That's going to be so interesting because as we heard in that trailer for Ellen's film, you know, it's like people want to cruise, but they don't necessarily want to go to Disneyland, right? And that's kind of a interesting dilemma when it comes to community. And Ellen, your film is basically, it's based about what's going on in the cruise industry in Sitka. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about Cruise Boom and why you made this film and what it's about.
Okay, so I guess I made this film because I was provoked because I have this weird background in film and anthropology. And I was provoked to like try to document the community going through a huge change because we have not been as cruise friendly in Sitka and as populated by cruises as Juneau and Ketchikan, Skagway, Hoonah. So what motivated me was that like, just it's a film that follows one community. It makes references to Juneau and Skagway and other places, and dealing with and grappling with both the positive and the not so positive and the questions people have. And it's filmed over a year and a half. It ends the fall before this fall. And we jumped. Our numbers were just a crazy, crazy jump. We had like 33,000 visitors in 2021. 379,022, and then over 500,000 in this last year.
Wow, that's quite a jump.
Yeah.
So what else did you learn from doing this film? What are some of the takeaways? I know we need to go see the film, but, you know, maybe one takeaway, a little teaser.
Well, I mean, I never know. I mean, I'm curious about how films are used and how they engage people. And I'm really curious what this film will say to other communities. One of the key lines is this one Mary Goddard says in the film, "We can shape tourism." And obviously Juno has done a lot to do that. But what does it mean to really shape tourism? One element in the film is a realm, something called regenerative tourism, which works really well in a small scale. But one question I really have, and Jim and I have talked about this, is how can you have kind of regenerative, sustainable tourism with in a kind of a mass industrial scale? And that's a question. I hope this film will get a little use here and there, and also make people who travel, when I'm hoping it'll be on a national PBS feed, think about their impact as visitors.
Right. So maybe seeing the communities that they're visiting a little bit differently. I know there was some trouble with the kutea, which were put up this summer, that people were, you know, touching them and climbing on them, and they didn't understand. There were no signs to say to not do that. And so people were, you know, just taking advantage of that, I think. So it's just interesting to think about that in terms of when you are traveling somewhere, what is your impact as an individual, not only on the community positively, but also maybe what's your responsibility when you get to that community for these other areas, like Jim's talking about with, you know, environmental impacts or other things in terms of how the community is treated. Because that your percentages that from that 1 year from 30,000 to 300,000, that's a huge jump. You know, that's
pandemic. Well, but you didn't say that area that shall remain nameless. Yeah, we that could to double. And I also think I also see films as like starters. Like they don't have footnotes. They can't have everything in them. So then people will really want to hear Jim's research and dig in more, because it's sort of like, you know, I mean, it's on a spectrum there.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're kind of the popular approach.
Yeah, for sure. And it is also going to play. What time is it playing on Saturday at the Gold Town if somebody can't make it out Friday?
At 4 p.m.
4 p.m. on Saturday.
We won't have Jim to set things up and give his presentation. So if people want to hear Jim, they have to come out to the university on Friday.
Well, absolutely, they should, because it sounds like there's some great information that you have, Jim.
Yeah, there's we can learn from others. And different situations, different populations, different cultures in the way we govern. But there's pieces there that are, I think we can learn. And actually, people are learning from us.
Mm.
Our tourism best management practices are being exported to other communities.
Including Sitka.
Yeah. So Skagway, Ketchikan, Sitka. Those are the short list, and I'm sure there's a longer list of these best practices that were put together in the early 2000s that we started. There were only 9 best practices. Now there's over 90, and there's over 100 people that sign on, operators that sign on, and they say, thou shalt, you know, do these things so we can make the community better or blend with the tourists.
It's one of the reasons that the university really wanted to have this conversation when Jim approached me. And I know that Jim and I have had a number of conversations about regenerative tourism. The university's interested in engaging the community in continued conversations around this subject. I've attended the Sitka Heritage and Cultural Tourism Conference, and I actually just got back from Greece, an international conference around regenerative tourism and cultural tourism and how other countries are handling this in their own areas, like New Zealand and Australia and Greece. And Alaska was a big conversation in that. And I do agree with Jim that we have an opportunity here to be leaders.
Yeah. Is there one thing that we could do as an individual that would be impactful in some way? Is there something that a listener could think about?
I think just staying engaged, listening to what's happening in your community, because there's opportunities to get involved. There's surveys that go out, and that really, those are looked at. And so there's an opportunity to participate in a survey. Excuse me. And there'll be other forums. In 2018, I put together neighborhood associations have an input into this all. We gathered them together. It was about 80 of us that gathered together and talked about tourism. That was pre-COVID.
Wow.
And so we really haven't, you know, COVID came on and things kind of dropped off because we had to focus on that. But now we're getting back into this, the fold of tourism. And I have to say that the operators here, you'll find out Friday night that they're doing some things too, because they know that we have a lot of people that need, it's a lot of people that are coming in our community.
That's great. In about 30 seconds, Karen, can you give us a preview of what's up next?
Yeah, absolutely. So following this talk, we'll have one more fall evening at Egan conversation, and that is Friday, December 8th. And that is called our Winter Fire Showcase. It's going to be Emily Wall, Ernestine Hayes, Lily Hope, and myself. And we are doing a creative, wonderful fusion. We're calling it a mesmerizing fusion of creativity.
Absolutely. And of course, you can find out more about Evening at Egan at uas.edu.
Yep.
And you can find out more about Ellen's film at cruiseboomfilm.com. It's the Evening at Egan lecture, Impacts and Responses, Cruise Ships and Northern Communities, Friday, November 10th at 7 p.m. with Dr. Jim Powell. And then you'll also see Ellen Frankenstein's film. I appreciate you all coming in. Gunnath Cheesh.
Thanks for bringing us in.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Have a wonderful Wednesday. On tomorrow, Culture Rich Conversations at 3 p.m., Black Culture and American Politics. Host Christina Michelle and her guests have an informative and unflinching conversation about the current state and the history of the Black community and its relationship with American politics. Juno Afternoon is heard on KTOO 104.3 Juno and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello out the road. Thanks, and have a glorious Juno evening.